Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Imagine taking a call one day to find out that someone you'd exposed as a fraud had taken their own life, presumably as a consequence, directly or indirectly, of your exposure of them. That's the scenario that faces journalist Susie Hamilton in the book we're talking about tonight, The Truth About Her, written by journalist Jacqueline Maley, who has taken her first foray into fiction. Susie writes an article which exposes a wellness blogger and sets off a chain of events which will see the blogger's parents seeking answers from Susie about her article about where the blame lies for her daughter's death. Now, Jacqueline, you know, as a Walkley Award-winning journalist and columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. And presumably, some of the dilemmas that face her character Susie are ones that she or her colleagues may have grappled with in their own careers. Jacqueline's in the studio for Nightlife tonight. Thank you so much for coming in, Jacqueline.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
The character who commits suicide that triggers the book, Tracy Doran, has some similarities with Belle Gibson, who was in the news. What questions did Belle Gibson's story raise in your mind about what happens when people's secrets are exposed to the media and the way people manipulate the media?
Look, I was interested in the story of Belle Gibson. I'm always interested in stories of frauds. I think they're really fascinating, and people who lie and deceive and, you know, who are pathological liars or whatever and rip other people off. And, you know, like recently we've had the case of Melissa Caddick, who is, I think everybody in Sydney has been gripped by, having defrauded, you know, most of her family and a lot of her friends. And I just thought it was an interesting premise for a book, if you like, or an interesting character in a book, because I wanted the book to be about lies and secrets and stories. I wanted it to be about the stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that we tell about other people and the consequences of those stories. And it seemed to me that the worst, you know, the most ultimate consequence you could have for writing a story as a journalist would be to have the person who you're writing about take their own life. And I think, you know, the blogger in the story has told a lot of lies and gotten really tangled up in them. But I also wanted that to have a parallel in the main character, who herself is lying, you know, who's lying to herself in the way that we all do. And it seemed to me that frauds, liars, pathological liars, they do something to an extreme extent that we all do to a moderate and hopefully not too harmful extent in our own lives. We all lie a little bit to each other. We lie to ourselves, even if they're sort of nice lies, like, you know, I'm okay, everything's fine. We all are deceiving ourselves at a certain point because we have to get by.
Is there a sense sometimes in newsrooms where if someone has done something terrible, like lie about a cancer diagnosis, that anything goes from that point on in terms of what you can write about them? Obviously, you'd write the truth, but in terms of the ethics of what you expose?
I think certainly maybe that was once the case. I think these days you have a lot more sort of victim-informed journalism and you think a lot more about the subjects of your stories. But certainly, you know, and it also depends on the subject and how vulnerable they are and, I don't know, what age they are and what position they hold in society and I guess a whole bunch of calibrations like that. But certainly I think to do your job well, if you are exposing someone in that way, you do have to have a certain detachment, and your responsibility and your duty is not to that person. It's perhaps to the victims of that person or to the people that they've harmed, and also to your readers, to tell the story accurately and objectively.
Is it something that you watch closely with your own journalism after a story comes out? The fallout, the potential consequences.
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of tension and I suppose the callousness that I wanted to write about at the heart of what a lot of us do as journalists, because, you know, the best stories, the biggest stories are the ones that have the most damning consequences for the people who are being exposed, who are the people of those, the subject of those stories. So, you know, you might have a minister have to stand down, or you might have someone lose their job, or, you might have someone have to pay reparations. You might have someone who's publicly disgraced. You might even have someone who goes to jail. So all of those are pretty serious consequences that can result from the stories that journalists write. And those stories should absolutely be written, and I would always stand by the right of journalists to write them. But I was interested in a fiction context of just kind of looking into the murkiness of that, because we show up on the worst day of a lot of people's lives. Something's happened to them, or they've done something to other people. And we write about it. We make it as public as possible. And there is, of course, a human toll to that.
The other human toll that immediately comes in the book is once the news breaks of Tracy taking her own life, Susie's own social media is full of people viciously attacking her, blaming her. This is something we hear a lot about, you know, trolls, what journalists go through whenever they put something out that might be controversial. Other people would, I guess, what are your thoughts on the ethics of that? I mean, do these online trolls actually have a psychological impact on the journalists they write to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I can speak a little bit from experience. I've never been trolled extremely viciously, and I've never been sort of the subject of a massive pile-on that I felt was really personal and vicious. But I'm a journalist in a, you know, for a newspaper. I have a Twitter profile. I have I have an email address. You can get very vitriolic and at times even violent emails from people. So I've had enough of a taste of it to know what it's like, and to know that it's much worse for women. There's a lot of female journalists who cop it, and cop it much worse than I do. And yeah, it absolutely has a psychological impact. I mean, I think you can become a bit hardened to it, and you can sort of decide how much you want to engage with it. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, particularly with something like Twitter, it might not look like a lot to other people, but if your timeline and your sort of mentions are completely just full of all these people shouting at you, sometimes I think it's like, you know, all of the voices that you of self-doubt and self-criticism and self-loathing that you have that in your own head that keep you up, or, you know, that talk to you at sort of 3 a.m. in the morning when you can't sleep. It's like they've been personified, and they're all there on Twitter, telling you what they really think of you. And yeah, of course that has a psychological effect.
Is there a way, I want to talk about the book specifically, but you know, when a journalist puts out a story and you disagree with it, surely there's a way that someone can engage with this and say, I think you're wrong, without necessarily engaging with the kind of bile we find.
Yeah, I mean, I think a good rule of thumb on social media is just not to make personal attacks. That's my rule of thumb. And also just never to get into arguments. I think arguments on Twitter are one of the greatest wastes of time.
I don't think anyone's ever been convinced online ever.
No, and I don't think anyone's ever been happier or made the world a better or more interesting place by having an argument on Twitter. I don't know. I mean, like, I get a lot of emails, and, you know, I write a column in the newspaper once a week, and I get really thoughtful, interesting emails, and some of them really robustly disagree with me. And as long as they disagree with me in a respectful way, like, I'm happy. That's great. Like, I'm not here to, you know, like, it doesn't bother me if people disagree with me, particularly when you're writing opinion. That's sort of what you're after, really, in a way. But it's just the way in which people engage. And I don't think there's any real art to it. It just, you know, you just have to be decent, really, and have your manners on.
That's a great rule of thumb. Have your manners on. Now, Susie Hamilton, your main character, at one point she says of her profile of Tracy, this influencer who's a fraud, she says, professionally, I had only ever sought to chase stories, to report facts faithfully, never to sculpt a person in three dimensions. And I think it's one of the ideas that you really explore through Susie, is that knowing the entirety of a person and faithfully reflecting who that person is to the wider world is possibly impossible. Mm. Are you conscious when, as a journalist, when you write about real humans, that you're only really recording a slice of that person's life and actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I mean. I go back to my earlier point about showing up on the worst day of someone's life. Like, you know, if someone had shown up on the worst day of your life and written about something, you know, that you'd done that you weren't particularly proud of, and then that was the only thing that people knew about you when they Googled you or when they read about you in a historical sense, we would have a distorted view of who Mark Sutton is, a lovely man, good father and husband, kind, funny. You know, we're not necessarily the sum of our worst moment. And yet journalists, sort of, that's what we do. We record people's worst moments. I like to think we do other things as well, but we do that. It's different if you're writing like a profile of a person and you're really trying to capture the essence of who they are. But again, like, you know, how can we ever know another person? How can we ever really know someone who's showing us a public face only? You can only really ever draw sketches of other people, and we never really know what's going on inside someone, do we? Like, we can never sort of peel off other people's skin and see what's really in them. So I think that's the project of fiction, and that's the project of literature, is trying to take people really inside another person and trying to describe everything and try to describe humanity, I suppose. You know, that sounds kind of grandiose, but trying to layer someone and give more of a vignette, give more than a vignette, you know, to give a full portrait of what someone's existence is like.
There's another theme in the book where there's a sexual relationship where there is a power imbalance. And this is something I think there's been a lot of discourse about lately, where, especially in a workplace, there might be a sexual relationship between two people where one is much more powerful than the other. And even though that relationship is consensual, there's still this issue of a power imbalance. Why was that something that you wanted to explore in the book?
I mean, that just kind of, that was just in service of the character. I had this idea of the main character as being a journalist who is under a lot of pressure in her personal life, and she's a single parent and she's shouldering a lot of responsibility. And I just had this idea that I wanted to write about disgrace. I knew that at the beginning of the novel, she had to have bad things happen to her that sort of catapulted her out of her life and her existence. And so she has the sort of the work, you know, crisis, catastrophe when this young woman she's written about kills herself. And then I wanted her to be shamed in her personal life in a way that sort of paralleled the character that she shames. And I mean, the main way that women are shamed in their personal life is due to their sex life. So that was sort of what I was trying to get at. And I thought, you know, what's sort of the most scandalous thing a person could do, and, you know, in a workplace context, and it probably would be having an affair with your married boss, which I hasten to add, I've never done. And, you know, Susie has a much more interesting personal life than I did, certainly while I was writing the book. But yeah, I wasn't thinking about it in those kind of Me Too, like I actually wasn't thinking about it in that way. And it's only actually in the interim, like in the, you know, I wrote the book in 2018 mostly. So that conversation about power imbalances and how, you know, powerful men often end up keeping their jobs and the less powerful women, you know, often end up losing them, that conversation's evolved since then. And I guess maybe I was just prescient. Maybe I was ahead of my time.
Well, that's so interesting, because that idea that, yeah, it takes two to tango in an affair like this. And yet we've seen situations where powerful men might have an affair. It's in the news, Barnaby Joyce, Alan Tudge, people like that, sort of a slap on the wrist in response. And yet the consequences for a woman can be huge. In terms of its use in fiction, why do you think that the character of Susie was kind of, I suppose my question is, in what way is her shame connected to her gender?
I think it's intricately connected to her gender. You know, I've written a book, you know, Susie is a mother, and so, you know, the main relationship in the book, I think, depicted is that she has with her small daughter, and I really wanted to write about that in Technicolor, in all its sort of glory and despair. And she... Yeah, I mean, she's shamed, and she's publicly shamed, and the most effective way, and really the sort of the most timeless way that women get shamed is through their sort of, yeah, their desires and their sex lives. And I think we still have a lot of that when we think about, you know, people who have an affair, you know, particularly if the man's married and the younger, perhaps younger woman isn't. You know, often we think, how could she do that? Doesn't she know he's got a wife at home? Doesn't she know he's got kids? All of which I sympathize with, but we don't often look at the man and sort of necessarily apply the same lens to him. So I do think there's a double standard there, which is very stubborn and enduring. And I was sort of interested in that, but I also just wanted her to have a really messy personal life. Like I just, in service of the character, I just needed her to have made an absolute mess of things. And to feel ashamed of herself because, you know, it's sort of morally wrong what she's done. And I was interested in that. I was interested in her sort of being in a position of moral authority, I suppose, in her journalistic life where she's exposing someone who's done something bad, but really she has a lot to answer for herself in her own life to the people that she has hurt and she's also been hurt by.
There's another element to the book, a big theme in terms of motherhood. Her relationship with Maddie, it's unmistakable how much she loves Maddie. It's unmistakable how much Maddie is the complete centre of her world. And yet the character is quite open about having a kind of loss of freedom as a result of being a new mother, or especially a single mother, who is perhaps unfairly being thrust into the role of a single mother where the partner does not help her out as much as they can. Is that tension between the undeniable love for your kid and the thought of what would my life be like if I hadn't had children something you wanted to explore?
I think it's not so much like what would my life be like if I hadn't had children, but it's the I wanted to depict motherhood honestly and faithfully and, you know, in quite a raw way. And my daughter was very young when I was writing this book, so a lot of those passages and a lot of that stuff about Maddie is really, really based on my own experiences. And I wanted to pour all the love and all the joy and all the humour of my own experience into a novel because I felt like that hadn't ever been really treated as a seriously true subject. You know, the minutiae of motherhood, how it feels on a day-to-day basis, not necessarily all the grand emotions, but what it is like to have to get a kid to school when you're juggling this, that and the other and they don't want to go and, you know, they won't brush their teeth and all of that stuff. I just thought, I've read so many books about, I don't know, the minutiae of all sorts of different things. But I've never read a book about this. So I really wanted to sort of, I wanted to plow all that into a literary work of my own. And I definitely didn't want to gloss over the fact that, you know, if you're a sole parent, particularly if you don't have, you know, if you don't have a co-parent out there, you do feel an enormous loss of freedom and you do feel that there's enormous weight of responsibility and, you know, a huge sense of duty, which, you know, you never resile from, but you can't pretend that you don't feel it, you know. And I wanted to put all of that into the book very much.
I was actually struck today by a tweet I saw where someone was saying, thinking about the canon of classic novels in literature, they almost couldn't think of any which dealt with motherhood as the key theme. You know, for such a one of the basic relationships in all humanity, and I started thinking about it, and I couldn't really think of one either. It is a really neglected, vital part of human life in literature.
Yeah, I that's exactly why, you know, one of the main motivations or one of the main reasons that I wanted to write this book, because, you know, I was a mother and, you know, I had a small child and I've always loved books. I've always, you know, I always have my head in a novel. I read a lot of books. And so that was sort of my escape when she was little. I would, you know, in the little time that I had to myself, I would go to books. And it struck me exactly that. Why are there no books about motherhood? We have mothers in literature and they're often, you know, they often are sort of ghoulish or ghastly figures. Sometimes they're benevolent.
There's a million books about the Oedipus complex.
Right. And there's a lot of books, you know, it's quite a sort of strong literary trope for, you know, to have an orphan or a waif or someone who's defined by the loss of their mother. But I was like, why? This is the most, you know, it's a universal relationship. Everybody's got a mum. And it is the fundamental relationship for most people's lives. it's full of so much intensity. It's so full of, you know, huge emotions and big events and a lot of pain and a lot of joy. And I'm like, this is the stuff of literature. You know, why is nobody tearing into this? So I decided to do it myself.
Also, mothers in literature are often figures seen through the lens of the child or seen as older matriarchal figures, and therefore sexuality and motherhood are rarely things I think you see in literature, and that's something that comes together in Susie.
Yeah, and I really wanted to do that as well. I didn't want her, you know, she has an active personal life, shall we say, unrealistically active social life, I might say, for a single parent. But I wanted her, I didn't want to do that thing where it's like she's just going out and having affairs with men because she's sort of damaged and she's trying to fill some hole in herself. Maybe that's part of her motivation, but I wanted her basically to be a woman who has desires that haven't been extinguished by motherhood, and she fulfills them in the best way that she can within the situation that she's in. And I wanted her to be sort of unapologetic about that.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the nice things is that even though there's a shame associated with one of her affairs, she doesn't feel seedy. And some of the other affairs she's having, or one of the other main ones, it's just a lot of fun. She's having a great time. And I think another thing in literature might be that authors tend to judge women who have affairs or have active personal lives. And I think it's really great in this book that that's not really what's going on.
Yeah, it was interesting because I had to, that judgment that you speak about, you know, I felt towards Susie throughout the book as I was writing it and as I was writing her. And I kept pushing her to do these things that I would never do and that I would feel sort of uncomfortable doing, I suppose. And I had to really separate myself and be like, it's okay. You know, it's okay. You can make her do all sorts of things. You're going to muck her up here. You're going to have her fall over here. You know, she makes a lot of mistakes. But I wanted to do that in service of the character. And yeah, I wanted her to be quite unapologetic about, you know, she's very sort of almost clinical in the sense that she's like, this is my life. I'm devoted to my daughter. You know, this is what I do. I have these other needs that I need to have mesh. And so I'm going to do that in the best way that I can within this environment. And she's sort of like, she just goes out and does it.
When you sat down at your laptop or your typewriter or with your quill pen or whatever your process is, you're used to writing heavily researched, truthful articles, and suddenly you are writing, albeit about the real world that you know, but a fictional story. What was the adjustment like?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question because it was a real adjustment. And there was a few things, like I liken it to sort of loosening a corset. Like you obviously, you know, a novel, I think this one's about 100,000 words. You know, that's a lot of words. You got a lot of time. You got a lot of space. You don't have to, whereas, you know, in journalism, even if you're writing sort of a long form feature, you're only writing a few thousand words and you really have to, you know, kill a lot of your darlings and really nip and tuck and get to things pretty quickly. And in a novel, you can meander, you can go off on tangents, you know, you can spend pages and pages on a single minute. I mean, you can do really whatever you like in terms of form and in terms of, you know, just the prose itself. So I had to kind of unleash myself and be like, you know, run free, do whatever you like. And you, even though, as you say, like some of the novel is sort of like the springing off point is sort of news events or things, you know, a newsroom environment that I know. Once I had that sort of bedrock, I was like, you know, you can do whatever you want, go nuts. Like I just had to kind of, yeah, completely take the seatbelt off and just like let myself gallop. And it was very, very freeing and exciting once I sort of the penny dropped.
And what made you want to take the seatbelt off in the first place? I mean, you have an established career as a journalist. Why turn to fiction?
I mean, I don't think of it as turning to fiction because I've always written fiction in bits and pieces kind of like secretly throughout my life. And in fact, you know, literature and fiction was my first love. And in many ways I went into journalism because I wanted to find a way that I could write for a living and actually sort of earn a living, I suppose, because I wasn't bequeathed with a trust fund, sadly. So I went into journalism. I was always interested in writing. I've always written on the side. I've always kind of inhaled novels. And I was writing seriously for, like, you know, quite a few years before this. And I did write another manuscript before this one of a different novel that was sort of like a starter or a practice novel that I ended up, you know, sort of putting in the bottom shelf. So it was quite a long road. And it was just something that I did on the side. And it was almost like, you know, it was almost like my little world and my little secret and my little freedom, because when you're on the page and it's only you and the page, you can really do whatever you like. It's incredibly liberating.
Well, the book is called The Truth About Her. It's published by Fourth Estate. Jacqueline Maley is the author. Jacqueline, thank you so much for coming in tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Check it out. It's available in all bookstores. Well, all good bookstores anyway.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.